From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Republican plan to replace President Obama's Affordable Care Act is moving forward on Capitol Hill. Two congressional committees stayed in session all night debating the bill. At the 22-hour mark this morning, around 8 a.m. Eastern, lawmakers on the House Energy and Commerce Committee debated the word freedom and what it means in terms of health care. Here's Oklahoma Republican Mark Wayne Mullen.
Earlier, I don't know, it may have been 21 hours ago, I brought up the fact that premiums across the board have raised by 25%, double digits. Oklahoma, premiums have raised by 76%. In Arizona, 116%. That isn't freedom.
And here's California Democrat Jerry McInerney.
In the wee hours of the night, there was a tone of bipartisanship, and that's gone now. So I'm going to say this. In healthcare, words like freedom, empowerment, and flexibility are code words for shifting costs to individuals. You'll end up paying more with this plan if you can get coverage at all.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving has been watching all this. He joins us now. Hi, Ron.
Hey, Jeremy.
So we hear there from some people on Capitol Hill, as we said, the bill is moving forward, but at the same time, it's facing a strong headwind from healthcare providers, medical groups, AARP, who have announced opposition to it. How much clout do those outside groups have in this debate?
You know, it ought to be a lot because in the end, all those groups you just cited, particularly doctors and nurses and hospitals, are going to have a lot to do with whether or not this new system succeeds or fails. We've been told pretty often that this is not just about healthcare insurance, but it's about getting people health care. And if that's true, if that really is the Republicans' objective with this replacement, they should be listening to the providers and doctors and nurses who are going to deliver that care.
And within the Congress, we're already seeing opposition from moderate Republicans and also from very conservative Republicans who thinks that the bill is too close to Obamacare. Do Speaker Ryan and the bill supporters have enough support? Will they be able to get enough support to get this thing passed?
They don't have it now, Jeremy, but they are working extraordinarily hard at getting it, and the president is pitching in. They do have a shot in the House, but they're going to have to reassure many of their hardcore conservatives, people like the Americans for Prosperity, the Freedom Works, the Tea Party Patriots, the Heritage Action, Club for Growth. This is the hardcore group that has been pushing against Obamacare for the last 7 years and before, and they don't like the replacement bill. So you've got maybe two dozen, three dozen people who are real tough sells on the right, and they can only afford to lose 21 votes because the Democrats probably won't produce a single vote for this bill.
And what about in the Senate?
Well, that's really where the problem is, and I think a lot of these House members don't want to be hung out to dry voting for something that may not be popular with all of their constituents just to have the Senate say no. And it is a problem of another order in the Senate. You have people like Rand Paul coming out from a libertarian perspective and saying it's Obamacare light or 2.0. You have moderates like Rob Portman saying, how is this going to affect the Medicaid expansion in Ohio, where I'm from and where John Kasich was pretty cooperative. And then you've got people, and this is a real big log on the fire, Tom Cotton of Arkansas,
right,
who suddenly sent out a tweet storm telling people that he's against it and he's got all kinds of problems with it and it's not got any chance of passing in the Senate. So that makes the people in the House feel nervous.
He told them to start over, which I wonder if they're going to listen to him on that one.
Probably not. They're not in any mood to start over because they're trying to jam this through in the window under reconciliation procedures so that they can pass it with
right,
a simple 51 votes in the Senate.
So, Ron, before we let you go, we are still waiting to learn more about how Congress is going to handle President Trump's claim that he was wiretapped by President Obama, which he has provided no evidence to back up. Yesterday, White House spokesman Sean Spicer struggled a little in explaining why President Trump might have been tapped. Here he is taking his first go at that question.
Is the president the target of a counterintelligence investigation?
I think that's what we need to find out.
But later in the press conference, an aide brought Spicer a note, and then Spicer added this.
What I'm saying is, the one question dealt with whether or not the tweet dealt with wiretaps during the thing. The other is an investigation. They are two separate issues. And there is no reason to believe that there is any type of investigation with respect to the Department of Justice.
Ron, explain this, and where does this go from here?
This has been a question from the very beginning. If the president thinks he was tapped or someone was tapping Trump Tower, why were they doing it? Were they doing it because there was some indication enough to get a warrant from a court that said you can do this because we see evidence of crime? Evidence of some kind of criminal activity, unspecified? If so, that's going to be a lot of questions for Mr. Trump or his campaign or somebody around Trump Tower to answer. So that's been a question from the very beginning. But here's the thing that they get out of doing this with that tweet storm on Saturday morning. Every minute we spend talking about that is one less we spend talking about the Russian connections to the Trump campaign last year, or so alleged. Mm-hmm. And they're adding fuel to a fire that may just burn longer and a little bit hotter.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, there are more U.S. boots headed for the ground in Syria. 400 Marines will join the few hundred U.S. Special Ops forces already in Syria. The Marines will reportedly take up heavy artillery to support the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces in an anticipated assault on Raqqa, the de facto ISIS capital. The Raqqa offensive would follow the current battle to retake the Iraqi city of Mosul from ISIS. We talked yesterday about how Iraqi forces are making progress in Mosul, but just suffered a devastating ISIS ambush. Let's bring in NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Robin.
And first, how imminent is this deployment of the U.S. Marines? Tell us more about their mission, too.
Well, it's pretty imminent. From what I understand, they've gone into Kuwait, and they will move from Kuwait into Syria. We don't have exact timetable of when that will happen. And what they'll be doing, as you mentioned, is providing artillery support for the upcoming attack on Raqqa, the de facto capital of the Islamic State. And again, 400 or so Marines, most of them will be providing security for the artillery battery, by the way.
Well, let's be clear, because, we have the advisors already in Syria. There are a lot of people, as you know, who eye roll when they hear advisor, especially post-Vietnam. There's a sense that there's maybe a blurring of the line between an advisor and somebody who actually takes up arms. But it sounds as if these Marines are taking up arms.
Well, certainly, yeah, because they'll be firing artillery, so they're taking up arms. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be very close to the front lines, though, so don't expect them to be firing their weapons at, ISIS or ISIS firing back at them. They'll be pretty far back. Some of these artillery pieces, can fire up to, 15 to 20 miles away. So they'll be far enough away from the fight to be safe, but close enough, obviously, to be effective in the use of their artillery.
Right. Well, nobody, as you know, is safe in that region. But does this get sticky? The Kurds, as we said, leading the Syrian Democratic Forces, but we hear there's tension between those two groups. Turkey isn't happy with the Kurds' involvement in Syria. And this is putting, U.S. troops in the middle of those tensions.
Oh, absolutely. This is very sticky. You have a problem of, first of all, you don't have enough ground forces right now. Local ground forces to take Raqqa. That has to be sorted out. You do have Turkey saying all Kurds are terrorists, so they don't want the Kurds to be part of this Raqqa fight. And then you have the Americans in the middle of it. Not only would these Marines be right down there by Raqqa, but you also have Army Rangers basically separating fighters up in this area of northern Syria, this town called Manbij, which is now being held by U.S.-supported rebels. They're trying to keep out Turkey-supported rebels and keep the Syrians and Russians at bay as well. They're sort of it's almost like a blocking force up there. So what you're seeing now is more and more American conventional forces involved now in Syria, which is interesting, as opposed to special operators who were mostly equipping, training, working with those Syrian and Kurdish fighters in Syria. Now you're seeing conventional forces. That's a big difference.
Well, in fact, there are reports that around 1,000 American troops are going to deploy to Kuwait to support this fight against ISIS. We spoke to you last week after the Pentagon delivered its plan to accelerate the war against ISIS. Is this plan coming to life now with these deployments?
Well, there's still a lot of unanswered questions. Clearly, they're going to send more troops into Syria. I'm hearing also Others will be sent into Iraq as well to help with that fight against ISIS. We don't have a sense of the numbers there in Iraq yet. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of unanswered questions about how the U.S. will work with Turkey and also Russia. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Joe Dunford, was in Turkey meeting with his Turkish and Russian counterparts about the way ahead. So will they create sort of safe zones in Syria? Will they come up with sort of spheres of influence in that country for the various powers, Turkey or Russia or the U.S.? What exactly is the way ahead here? And some of those questions have yet to be answered.
Well, and you remind us with just a few seconds here, when a similar artillery unit was deployed in northern Iraq, they were hit by ISIS missiles and a Marine was killed. So obviously that's on everyone's mind.
Absolutely, particularly in the Marines' mind, as they head into Syria, they're going to be very concerned about providing for their own security to make sure something like that doesn't happen
right.
again.
NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
Our next guest, George Perez, is known as the Condo King of Miami. He's also been called the Donald Trump of the tropics. As a real estate developer, he's helped shape the skyline of Miami and has been a business partner with President Trump over the years. But their relationship is under some strain lately. Joining us now, George Perez, chairman and CEO of The Related Group. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
And we have a lot to talk to you about, but I want to start by asking, how is your relationship with President Trump right now?
I think that's the question that I ask all the time now, right? President Trump and I have been friends for over 20 years, and we used to talk a couple of times a month. We've been business partners. We've been social friends and had a very good relationship for a very long time. And then when he ran for president, he asked me to help. And I said, you know, I'm supporting Hillary Clinton and I'm a liberal Democrat. And I wasn't able to help him. And then I reached out to him and congratulated him when he won the elections, you know, telling him I was a friend and I hoped he unified the country. And I wished him well and a great presidency. He called me a couple of times. We talked first about the Department of Housing and Urban Development, then about Latin America, a little bit about Cuba. And it was very friendly, you know, asked me for advice, asked me if I wanted to serve in the government. But since I made the statements about my opposition to the famous wall, I haven't had any more communications with the president.
And he wanted you to help him build the wall, and you said no.
Yes, he sent me an email saying, please call me. Here's the wall. Are you interested?
Yeah. Hmm. So he hasn't been calling you lately?
No.
Hmm. And why did you decide you didn't want any of the jobs in the administration that he offered you?
Well, you know, it's a difficult decision because on one side, you want to help the country. And on the other side, you know that particularly, for example, in housing and urban development, where I think I spent 40 years both as an urban planner and as a developer, I think if there's anything I know a little bit about is housing and urban development. And I'm a big proponent of, you know, subsidies, you know, in order to be able to provide, you know, affordable quality housing to those that can't afford it. And I thought that the Republican administration was going to go towards a different path, one that is probably going to try to cut the budget of the Department of Housing and Urban Development and not pay so much attention to housing. So I didn't think of myself as spending a few years butting my head against total policies. At the same time, I felt a little bit bad and that maybe I could have made a difference in keeping housing programs in that were very necessary. So when he called again and said, would you be interested in undersecretary? Because, you know, the chosen secretary does not have, you know, great housing experience.
Ben Carson.
He's a surgeon. Yes. He's a surgeon. I met with Mr. Carson and I said, no, I'm not interested in being the undersecretary, you know, which will really be the sort of the expert in housing. But I gave him some recommendations that hopefully they called to try to fill housing positions with housing experts.
Would you run the National Endowment for the Arts if he asked you to do that?
No. and the reason for no is I don't consider myself an arts expert. I'm a collector, you know. That's an interesting question. I mean, I shouldn't say no. But I would have the same problem, right? I mean, you know, President Trump, I keep on trying to call him Donald, but President Trump has made it very clear that he wants to eliminate both the National Endowment of the Arts and National Endowment of the Humanities, which is something that I would be very much opposed to. I was, you know, a member of the National Endowment of the Arts at a time where we were suffering huge cuts and huge attacks. And it were difficult periods. We managed to save it and actually increase it a little bit, you know. But it's a drop in the bucket, you know. The elimination of these programs is just purely symbolic, as it's such a minute part of the national budget that it would make absolutely no difference in trying to balance any budget.
I have one more Trump question for you, which is, you've known him for a couple of decades. Is there something that you know about him that you wish the rest of America knew about him?
I knew a different Donald Trump. I mean, I did not discuss immigration or national health care or the environment. We discussed business. You know, we were friends and we discussed social things and business matters, you know, sports, you know, real estate, and family matters, right? I mean, our wives knew each other. We went to concerts together, went to dinner together. And as a social person, he's a very charming guy. He was a great partner. We never had an argument, you know, in the projects that we did. You know, he, like I, always demanded luxury in the buildings that we did together. I paid great attention to detail. He was very proud of what he did. I remember him showing me, you know, Mar-a-Lago's new ballroom and everything that he'd done, you know. And I always found them to be, with me, caring and charming. And a person to have a very good time, a very good evening with. I don't know him as a political animal, so I was very surprised when he announced, because I never knew him to be so interested in politics.
Well, let's talk about housing, and you just brought it up there. But you, as the condo king of Miami, as they call you, went through the downturn about 10 years ago. Do you think that another one is on the way, as some people do?
No, I don't. I think we've seen an equilibrium in the market. I think the market has cooled down, which it needed to. And the biggest difference between now and in 2009 2010, 2008, is leverage. You know, today, most of the condominiums that we're building in Miami have very little financing. Buyers have put in very substantial down payments, at least 50% of the purchase price. So that is going to make, you know, to make it very difficult to see a downturn, a severe downturn. I think that we're going to see more of a cooling down over the next couple of years. And then, you know, key areas, you know, key cities like Miami will then come back, you know, with a bang. You have to remember that the world sees Miami as an exciting city and also as a very safe city. And as opposed to Latin American cities, they're not the risks of monetary fluctuations, you know.
But are you saying that the buyers are mostly foreign buyers that are coming in and putting the money down?
My gut is that, you know, that yes, you know, Miami is sort of the Phoenicia of old. You know, we are a trading city. We're an international city. I think we will always have a large part of our demand for condominiums coming from the outside, especially Latin America.
So in addition to being a real estate developer and a billionaire, you're also a major patron of the arts. You donated $55 million in cash and art to the Miami Art Museum, which is now called the Perez Art Museum Miami. How has that been working out? Have you revived it? Has the art scene in Miami changed dramatically since that happened?
Yeah, I mean, we have, and you know, and we had big expectations, you know, from the museum, and I think we've surpassed all our expectations. Every month, every year, every month keeps on getting better and better, not only in the numbers, you know, that we're seeing coming, visiting the museum, not only locally, but internationally. The reputation of the museum has grown beautifully. So we're very, very pleased with the progress of the museum. We try to make sure that we represent the population of Miami. And by that, I'm saying we want to make sure that it's art that talks to all the different segments of the community. And I think it has contributed, you know, to the growth of that art scene in Miami. More and more artists are living here. We're trying to get more residencies to come to Miami. And if you look at the artists, you know, sometimes I'm surprised. I mean, it's like, this is where we would like to be exhibited, or this is the museum that we would like to have our collection in. So Miami is a very important part of Latin America's life. And being part of it by being shown in the museum or by being in the museum collection becomes a sign of prestige, you know. So, you know, we've been able to market that well in Latin America. And because of that, a lot of collectors, artists, galleries, and so forth continue to come to Miami. And not only is it artistically and humanly edifying, but it's an economic engine. The arts, you know, have produced a lot. You look at Art Basel, you know, it's amazing, the satellite fairs and right. The number of galleries that have opened here in Miami, the number of restaurants around areas like Wynwood because of the galleries and the population coming to visit those galleries. So it's a big economic engine.
That's George Perez, who is the chairman and CEO of the real estate development company, The Related Group. George Perez, great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. And you know, a lot of people don't know that podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. At Here and Now, we want to change that. So all this month, we're inviting listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag tripod, that is hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks. The Oakland Raiders are moving closer to the end zone on their bid to relocate to Las Vegas. According to a report from the Los Angeles Daily News, NFL owners on the stadium and finance committees are ready to recommend the move come up for a vote when the NFL holds its annual meeting in 3 weeks. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
And these NFL moves always seem to be about teams wanting new stadiums so they can make more money. Is that the case here?
Yeah, that's the way to maximize profit. And so we see the Chargers moving and the Rams now playing again in Los Angeles. And yes, a new stadium means big suites and big revenues for the owners. And a lot of cities, especially cities where the teams currently are, do not want to be held hostage, do not want to essentially fund a stadium and, you know, say, we'll do a little something. We're not even going to meet you halfway. Whereas cities without teams will do anything, not anything, but do a lot to lure a new team and make the owner that much richer.
And is the city of Las Vegas or the state of Nevada ready to put up a bunch of money to get a new Raiders stadium?
They would argue no, but I think that's dishonest. What they've done is they've passed a hotel tax, and I think about half a dozen teams do this. And so they sell the hotel tax to their people as, hey, it's not a tax on you, right? It's a tax on other people coming in and staying in your hotels. But the reason that you shouldn't look at it like that is because if you can raise money through a hotel tax, you could use that money for education. You could use that money for roads, right? If a hotel tax can be borne, what you do with the money is essentially taking money, $750 million in the case of Las Vegas, and using it for something. And then when you define that something as a new football stadium, I would say that's akin to a tax on the city. And also, you know, higher cost of staying in hotels will, to some degree, depress the number of people that stay in hotels. So, yeah, it's a tax.
So we know that Las Vegas has a bit of a gambling problem, Mike.
No. It's a gambling virtue. Please.
Right. So what about that concern? Because this is what we all talked about when the NHL decided they're going to have a franchise in Las Vegas, that if you put a professional team there, it's just going to be all betting on that team all the time, and who knows what the consequences will be.
Yes, I think that's kind of an antiquated worry to some extent. I mean, just because there's gambling legal there. First of all, there's gambling illegally everywhere in the United States. And then even online, which is illegal, it's easy to access that. I do have to say, though, the news here about the Raiders moving, if listeners haven't been paying that much attention, they might say, oh, wasn't this always in the works? Yes, but the hotel magnate, Sheldon Adelson, he was the one who was originally behind the move. He was backed by Goldman Sachs, and he pulled out, and he does own casinos. When he was going to be the Raiders financing, it did make the NFL a little nervous, direct tie to a casino. Now that Bank of America is putting up the funding, I mean, the Carolina Panthers play in Bank of America Stadium. Bank of America doesn't own a casino. I think that makes the owners much less worried, and there's not that one objection, like, we don't want to be tied to casinos. So when the owners do vote on this, which, as you said, could come very soon, there's not such a great argument for preventing the Raiders from moving.
That's Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, thanks.
You're welcome.
To Iceland now. 20 years ago, teens in Iceland were among the heaviest underage drinkers in Europe. 40% of all 15 and 16-year-olds said they were drunk in any given month, and they were smoking everything. So fast forward to 2017. Iceland now has the fewest drinking, smoking, drug-taking kids on the continent. It's amazing. So what happened? And can it be replicated? Well, part of the credit can be given to an American who got his PhD in the early 70s. He realized people had different personality types and reasons for using drugs, but basically it was to deal with stress. And maybe getting kids naturally high would keep them from artificial highs down the road. Harvey Milkman now teaches psychology at the Metropolitan State University of Denver. He's also a visiting professor at Reykjavik University in Iceland. His work there was profiled in Mosaic magazine. Professor Milkman, welcome, or should I say velkommen?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Before we start talking about Iceland, briefly tell us what it was you realized when you were researching people back in the 70s who were using, that was the first wave of heroin and amphetamine abuse.
We found that, sure enough, they did have different personality styles, that the heroin users were characterized by passive withdrawal in terms of their style of coping with stress, and the amphetamine users were opposite. They were characterized by active confrontation, so they were active, extroverted people who were playing all-night music, they were doing construction work, and when they were under stress, they wanted to amp up their level of active confrontation with their environment.
Well, so you found, okay, two different ways that people were using drugs to deal with stress. As you said, heroin users just wanted to get away from it, numbing it, amphetamine users, you know, confronting it. But then you had the aha moment was when you realized, wait, it's not about the drugs. Of course, that was the big problem. It's about the way they coped with stress. That's what they were abusing.
That's right. You know, we had that aha moment. It was the style of coping that they were becoming addicted to. And so that led me to a conversation with a very renowned brain scientist, Stanley Sunderworth. And he said, almost immediately, of course, they're getting addicted to changes in their brain chemistry. And then we knew we were onto something.
Right. This idea that it's how you were feeling that you were then dealing with the drugs, and your thinking was, well, why don't we see if we can change how they're feeling before they get to the drugs? And so your thinking translated into what with kids?
Well, we knew that the brain was a giant pharmaceutical factory that manufactured its own mind-altering chemicals. And if people are getting addicted to self-induced changes in brain chemistry that could be translated into drugs or behaviors, why not start a natural highs movement where they could become influence to change their brain chemistry in positive ways that would benefit themselves and the society? And so in 1992, a legendary African-American dance choreographer, Cleo Parker Robinson, and I were awarded $1.2 million to start a natural highs program for at-risk youth. And we gave them music and art and dance and whatever they really wanted to learn in the area of healthy recreational activities. And then we also gave them a mindfulness program so that they could learn the skills to manage their own thinking. And we were tremendously successful with that. And that's when the conversations really started with Iceland about offering people healthy ways to change their brain chemistry.
Part of me is saying, Well, this makes so much sense. You know, this right. is what kids used to have in school. There were tons of after-school activities. Now you take this to Iceland. How bad was it in Iceland?
Well, it was really a frightening scene on a Friday night. There were hordes of drunk teenagers, and they were in-your-face drunk and sometimes shouting obscenities and rowdy, and then you really didn't want to be on the streets. So it was people were really becoming concerned in Iceland about what was happening to their teenage population.
You helped come up with a program called Youth in Iceland, and it covers every area of life. It starts with questionnaires to every school in Iceland, you know, anonymous. But then talk about the pillars of the program. Parents got involved, families got involved. What happened?
Policymakers, researchers, practitioners, people who work with kids, school teachers, coaches, nurses, doctors, and even corporations. So they all got together and decided we're going to have this as a kind of a collaborative effort to help kids. So it's important to realize that working with the surveys, they discovered that the things that really stood out in terms of what was correlated with high drug abuse were how strong were the relationships with the family, how much time was the family spending with the kids, what kind of peer groups were the kids hanging around with, and really important was the available recreational activities.
So after getting the results of the survey, as you said, all aspects of Icelandic life get involved. Laws are changed. It's illegal to buy tobacco under 18 or alcohol under 20. Advertising for both were banned. Laws were passed prohibiting kids 13 to 16 from being outside after 10 p.m. in winter or midnight in summer. But I love this piece. Parents have to sign all sorts of pledges. They have to go to talks on spending time with kids, and they're told it's not quality time. It's quantity time. Explain that.
You can't have a once a month taking the kid to the movies and call it good. So it has to be quality and quantity of time. So how much time are you spending with your kid every day and during the week? And then people were able to get that message. And the whole country got the idea that it really is important to spend time with your kids. And so from 1997 to 2012, the time spent with parents doubled for 15 to 16-year-old kids, and then they had a corresponding reduction in substance abuse and other problem behaviors.
Wow, it's just incredible. Parents had to sign pledges that they wouldn't allow their kids to have unsupervised parties, they wouldn't buy alcohol from minors. They'd keep an eye on the well-being of other children, and parents will recognize this, so that when your kid says, everybody else can, you don't have to just say, I don't care about everybody else. You can say, no, they're not. You know, we've all
right.
signed this pledge.
And I think another part of it, Robin, is the leisure card. Every family knows that the government is providing them with a voucher to give their kids art, music, dance. So there's basically a budget of about $250 per family per kid. Ping pong, badminton, soccer, gymnastics, all the kind of athletic activities you can imagine. But in addition, following the lead of that Cleo Parker Robinson and I developed, the music, the art, the dance. Not every kid wants to do sports, and they can self-select, which is really connected to their abilities and their passions and so on.
You know, again, this makes so much sense. You know, if you're in a town where, you know, just a handful of kids make the basketball team and everybody else just becomes feral, you know, in the afternoon
right.
with nothing to do. But what about cost?
So it's really a combination of government support and corporate support and tax support. And look, $250 a year is a very small price compared to the what it costs to when a kid becomes adjudicated and requires
yeah.
probation or incarceration or something like that. It's a minor expense.
But it's not just the cost of joining. It's hiring all the people who run programs. I mean, you know, somebody in America might look at this and say, oh, that's just more government interference in our lives.
Right.
And by the way, you're talking about millions of people here as opposed to just, you know, thousands in Iceland. Do you think it's transferable?
Well, you're right. I mean, the ratio is about 1,000 to 1. So to every one person in Iceland, there's 1,000 people in the United States. But we can think about different municipalities for sure in the United States that can replicate the Icelandic model. I mean, we have 17 different countries in Europe that are doing it across 35 different municipalities. We have a Youth in Europe project. Certainly there would be a beneficial effect. A special sort of aspect of solving these problems is to recognize community by community what the problems are and then tackle them in terms of the resources that the community has, mm-hmm. let them solve some of their own problems through their own agency.
And in Iceland, we talked about the phenomenal results. I mean, repeat those. Really, was it just, is it gone from in-your-face drunk kids to deserted streets?
Well, it really did. I mean, it went from drunk in the past 30 days, 42% of the 16-year-olds were doing that, and went down to 7%. And in terms of daily smoking, it went from 23% to 3%. In terms of using cannabis in the past year, it went from 17% to 5%. So the results are remarkable. They're astounding. And we're seeing it in Europe, and we should be having elements of it deployed throughout the United States as well.
I can think of families that would just give anything to have this, to give their kids a natural high before they even think of a pharmaceutical high. That's Harvey Milkman, a psychologist at the Metropolitan State University of Denver, but also visiting professor at Reykjavik University in Iceland. Harvey, thank you.
Thank you.
Recent rains have eased the drought in California, but as a new film shows, the state's water problems are far from over. Water and Power, A California Heist, airs on the National Geographic Channel next Tuesday. It begins with some spectacular shots of the California Aqueduct, a man-made project stretching hundreds of miles, bringing the water from the north to the south. Here's how journalist Mark Arax describes it.
Because of that manipulation of water, a great civilization has risen. We've created two world-class cities, Los Angeles, San Francisco. And in the middle, we created the most fertile farm belt the world's ever known.
But as the film shows, the demands of the big cities, agriculture, and secret deals made over water rights put water access in jeopardy for many Californians. If it sounds a little like the 1974 film Chinatown, that's not a coincidence, as the film's director, Marina Zenovich, told us.
This was pitched to me as Chinatown, the documentary. You know, the film is trying to help you understand what is happening within a very complicated system of water rights. I think it was Robert Towne who said it best, who wrote Chinatown. He said, you know, the Department of Water and Power, they pretty much tell you what they're about.
And in this case, it sounds like one of the problems is the water has to be used by everybody in California, but there are a few people who have a lot more control of it than you would think.
Well, that's what we came to discover in doing the research for this film, and that's what the film kind of exposes. You know, unfortunately, there are water oligarchs. There is something called investment farming. You know, there are companies coming into California and buying up land ostensibly for the wine, but some people are saying that wine is the cover crop. They're in it for the water.
That's underneath their vineyard.
Exactly. So there are a lot of issues that we cover that are opening a window into this world that the people in the world have kind of tried to keep from the people, if you will.
Well, and one of the key characters is somebody that people may have heard of, even outside of California, Stuart Resnick, who is the man behind the Palm Wonderful Company, which makes pomegranate juice. And he's also got a lot of almond trees and things like that.
Yeah, we feature a couple of water oligarchs. We reached out to the Resnicks and tried to get them to be interviewed, but they didn't want to take part in the documentary. Mark Arax, someone we do follow in the film, interviewed Mr. Resnick at a certain point. So we have Mark telling the story of Resnick, and we also have John Vitovich, who's a farmer and developer. And, you know, it's a fascinating world, the world of water.
Well, let's listen here to a little bit of John Vitovich from your film.
So if I can't make money on that water farming, I will sell it eventually to an urban area. And that's a right I have. If they pass a law saying I can't sell it, then I can't sell it. But that's the way it is. That's business.
That's business. And a business that I guess a lot of people would say shouldn't be a business at all. This is something that everybody needs. And it's part of what's underneath the ground in the state of California in this case. You do focus in this film also on how much groundwater, not just in California, but around the country, is being tapped. People just taking these groundwater reserves and using the water.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty astounding. California is one of the last states, if not the last state, to have a law for the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act is the law that was enacted in, I think, 2014. So they will start regulating groundwater. California is one of the last states to put this law into effect, but it's taking several years for it to take effect. And as a result, I think you have businesses and individuals who are coming in and pumping up the groundwater. And I think that what I really took away from this project is there's a lot of greed out there, and water is a human right. We need people to be transparent about people, politicians, investment farmers, to be a little more transparent about what they're doing.
I couldn't help but notice, though, as I watched this film, that the drought is now essentially over in California. Do you think the momentum is lost at this point for any kind of changes to happen because now people have enough water once again?
I think people will have some false sense of it being over, but it's really not over. You know, groundwater has been depleted over hundreds of years. So, yes, we've had these rains. We don't know when we're going to have them again. I mean, what's been interesting in watching the film after the recent storms is you see how California has a history of drought and floods. And basically, it's just going to continue. So it is great that it did rain, and it could give people some false sense of security. But I think we have to think long term. And you add climate change to that, and, you know, it gets even more complicated.
That's filmmaker Marina Zenovich, whose film Water and Power, A California Heist, will air on the National Geographic Channel on Tuesday. Marina, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.